So today what I'd like to do is I would like to explain something about the proof of one fundamental identity which got used last time at the end, and that is that if we take this generating function, which remember is an ordinary modular form of weight 3/2 valued in the arithmetic Chow group, so this is this guy, so I'll just remind you of that. This is phi hat 1 of tau valued in Chow hat 1 of the arithmetic, valued in the arithmetic Chow group of M. If we take the height pairing, remember also that there's a height pairing on here. Which? Well, okay, but this for me is already a complex vector space, in which case I don't need a power series in Q. I'm thinking of this as a complex vector space. We've complexified, the Chow group has been complexified. Well, the point is that the series converges. The series converges and can be viewed as... We're past that now. We started with a generating series like this, but now... Okay. Anyway. Okay. Anyway, I can take two of these things and take their height pairing. In other words, apply the height pairing like this. And the key identity, which we used in the process of relating this to the L functions in the previous lecture, was the fact that this thing here, this pairing, is related to a certain Eisenstein series of genus 2 and weight 3/2, restricted to the diagonal, but you have to take the derivative at S equals 0. So this was the key thing that we had last time, this identity. I'm going to discuss this Eisenstein series very carefully in a moment, so I won't say much more about it now, except that I'll just say that it has weight 3/2, as do these two guys. So this is a Siegel genus 2 Eisenstein series, but we've restricted it to the diagonal. So, of course, we have H cross H embedded in H2. So we have this embedding, and we're pulling back this Eisenstein series under this embedding, so it now has weight 3/2, 3/2 in the two variables. In any case, we have this identity, and let me also remind you that what congruent meant was that the difference between these two things, which is a modular form in two different variables separately, it's a modular form in tau 1 and in tau 2, is some kind of a combination of theta series coming from O1s. That's what we used last time. And that's what I will prove more or less completely today. But in fact, what we believe is that you can simply replace this by equal, that in fact, this is equal to this, and we're very close to establishing that. So this business about these extra things for these O1s and so on is actually in the end going to be irrelevant. But we haven't finished proving that, but we have finished proving the statement if you write this statement. And this is all we needed for the L functions. So that's why, except for one point, which I'll point out in a moment. Okay. Well, of course, the weight doesn't change. The weight doesn't change, right? So in other words, it's just like if you took, remember, yesterday I also wrote down this Eisenstein series of weight 3/2 for SL2 with this convergence factor, absolute C tau plus D to the S minus something or other, and then I had a V in there. And the V in there meant that that whole thing is simply invariant, so it doesn't change the weight. So the weight doesn't vary with the S. Okay. So this is the identity I want to discuss. Let's see, I guess... Finding the right page here. Oh, okay. So let me just first say a little bit of reduction of this thing on the two sides, just to give you some hint as to what's going to follow when we make this comparison between this thing and this thing. The comparison will be done sort of as a computation. We'll compute both sides of this thing and compare things. But if I think of this as a modular form in tau 1 and a modular form in tau 2, it has a Fourier expansion, which of course is just the pairing of the generating series with itself. So if I looked at this, this is clearly the sum on T1 and T2 in Z. So these both are in Z. Of the pairing, Z hat T1 V1, Z hat T2 V2, times Q1 to the T1, Q2 to the T2. These are just the parameters. We're coming back to the formal power series in the two parameters. Okay? So that's what this is if you simply plug in the generating function here. So it's just a pairing. These are the coefficients of T1, T2 here. And of course, on the other side, what we have is this Siegel modular form. So I'm jumping a little bit ahead of the game just sort of to fix the ideas a little bit. This Siegel modular form, of course, has a Fourier expansion before I restrict to the diagonal, which depends on symmetric matrices of 2x2, binary symmetric matrices. So capital T, which would be typically T1 something something T2 in sim2 of Z. So typically this would be the Fourier parameter, this would parameterize the Fourier coefficients of this guy before I restrict to the diagonal. Of course, once I do restrict to the diagonal, this M is not seen anymore because I'm taking the trace of T tau, capital tau. And so if this is diagonal, all I see is the T1 and T2. And so I can rewrite this side. Now, in advance, I'm planning to compare these two sides. So this one you see is naturally a Fourier series in T1 and T2. This one is also if I lump the T's, which have a fixed diagonal. And so this side should be written as a sum, T1, T2, exactly the same range of summation. And then a sum on T, where the diagonal of T is equal to T1, T2. And then we take here E prime 2 tau 1 tau 2 0 B. And this whole term here for a fixed T1 T2 will be essentially the Q1, this analogous Fourier coefficient. I have written down just the whole, I'm sorry, I forgot to put T. Yep. I take the T-th coefficient upstairs. When I restrict, this behaves like this by the argument I just gave you. And so all these terms with this thing like this correspond to the coefficient here. If these are going to be equal, this coefficient has to correspond to this sum. So this is what we're going to discuss. So that's jumping ahead a little bit to explain what we're going to compare here. Okay, so maybe I'll leave that up and start over here to discuss a little bit more about the definition of E2 tau SB. And I'm going to give a little bit of details, not too many, but one of the main points that will come out is the way in which this some of the phenomena that we saw with theta dichotomy last time and Walsh-Bourget's theory are embedded in the structure of this Eisenstein series. So that seems to be one of the key points in this construction. Okay. So first let me remind you just about constructing this type of Siegel, degenerate Siegel-Eisenstein series in general. So if I let's say G double prime A be the metaplectic cover of SP2A. So this will be the global group that we're going to build Eisenstein series on. The weight 3/2 forces us to work with the metaplectic group. And inside of SP2, I have this Siegel parabolic, P, which is MN, the Siegel parabolic, which, if you like, is a stabilizer of a maximal isotropic subspace in the four-dimensional symplectic vector space, but another way of saying it would be just to be more precise about what M and N are. This is the set of all things like this, A transpose A inverse. A is in GL2. And the unipotent radical looks like the set of all NB. I don't need this, but we might write it anyway. B is in SIM2. So this is the usual Siegel parabolic like this, inside of the usual symplectic group. Okay. So the induced representation, which will correspond to this family of Eisenstein series, will be a degenerate principal series. So we have IS is the degenerate principal series. So what is this? This means I'm going to, okay, let's just write it over here as an induced representation. I induce from P A, where I maybe should put some indication that I'm in a double cover, but I won't. And here I'll just put absolute value to the S. So this is some kind of normalized induction. But let me write down how a function in there will transform. If I have a section in there, what this means is that this section of N of B, M of A, G, S, and I'm being sloppy about the metaplectic aspect here. If you're an expert, you know how to fix this. And if you're not, I can't explain it in the few minutes that I have. So we'll just ignore it. In any case, what happens here is you get determinant of A, Hilbert symbol with -1, times the V index of determinant of A for the additive character, which I have not written here, but will be involved in all the V representations and so on that I'm using, times here absolute value determinant of A to the power S plus 3/2, and then finally phi of G S. So this is how functions in this induced representation transform on the left under PA. So this is just some garbage character. It's a character of the metaplectic cover. That's why there's this thing here. And then this is normalized induction. Jim is looking puzzled again. What's the problem?
Okay.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, then I can't help you. Okay. Okay, so this is just the transformation law of such functions. So ignoring this silly little character here, it's just like this. This is rho, by the way, for this parabolic. Okay, so these are the type of functions one can, this is global now, and so if I have a section like this, I can form this Eagle-Eisenstein series. This is a very standard construction, just in the style of Langlands. This will be the sum on rational points of the group, phi of gamma g s. So this is the series, part of the Eisenstein series. And this is okay for real part of S greater than 3/2. Again, in the Langlands normalization, it's bigger than rho. You put a rho here and you get a rho here in the half plane of absolute convergence. So this is the picture. And so the picture here like would be something like this. This would be, say, 0. Here's 3/2. We initially get convergence in this half plane over to the right of 3/2. And it has a meromorphic continuation to the whole S plane. And the point we're interested in is 0, the center of symmetry. And, of course, the functional equation in this Langlands normalization relates S and minus S. I'm not going to write it because I don't need it, but nonetheless, that's how it goes. Okay. So that's the general family of Eisenstein series in question here. But, as you, of course, up there, we just need this one of weight 3/2. So I'm going to start specializing this thing little by little to describe that particular one. Okay. So, first of all, we'll restrict to weight 3/2. And what this means is that the section, the global section that we're going to use in our Eisenstein series, will be written as a local section at infinity, a tensor, a finite part. Okay? Now, this local section at infinity, 3/2 infinity of S, is in the local induced representation. So you can imagine just taking that formula which I've written, which is an Adelic formula, and specializing it to any prime, infinity, finite prime p, and so on. And you get then a corresponding local discrete degenerate principle series. So I'll write up here, just for reference, this is the tensor product of the corresponding local degenerate principle series. It's, of course, a restricted tensor product, and so on. So in any case, the section I'm talking about here is eigen for U2 tilde inside of G double prime R, the metaplectic cover of the real group, with eigenvalue determinant to the power 3/2. So this will correspond to classical Siegel modular form. So it's an eigenfunction for K with this character. Okay. So this is, of course, just a double cover of U2, and if I square this character, I get determinant cubed on U2. It descends if I square it, but it's the square root. Okay, so there's a unique such function in here with the property that its value at the identity is 1. This k-types in here have multiplicity 1. And so I've told you everything about this. And so that's what we're going to take at infinity. So if we make that assumption, we can define an Eisenstein series now, which we're pushing down to make it classical, because all my generating functions have this classical tau in them. So now I'm just going to push this. The weight is fixed. This function is fixed. So I may as well work on the upper half plane as far as the Archimedean part is concerned. So we define e tau s. Let's see, what else do I need? 3/2 will record the weight here, and for any section over the finite part, that's just this part now, this is by definition determinant of V to the 3/4 times E of G, G of tau, S, phi and 3/2 infinity, tensor, phi, finite. The previous, this is the previous series, except now G is just in the Archimedean group. G tau is in G double prime R, and it has the property that if I apply it to I get tau. Here I is in H2, and so there's just some choice of an element like that. Okay, so this is the standard way of passing from the upper half plane to the group, and vice versa. So So this guy here is now going to be weight 3/2 in a classical sense for some congruent subgroup, depending on how you choose this. So this is part of a general construction. But now what I'd like to do is to choose more carefully the finite part here, because I would like, in the end, to define this guy with the B here. And so somehow I haven't used B at all, except for the 3/2, which we knew we were going to get. And so I'd like to describe how to choose this guy in terms of B. That's the next step. Okay, now to do that, maybe I'll start here, we should look again at the local components. So remember now we have these induced representations, IPS, of which the global and degenerate principal series is the tensor product, and the finite part is, of course, just the tensor product over the finite primes here. So we have these guys we care about. And it turns out, okay, so now what I want to describe, how do I describe these? Okay, so remember from last time, we had quaternion algebras. I'm fixing a finite prime here. The 3/2 already takes care of infinity, so infinity's out of the picture at this point. For some finite prime, I have two quaternion algebras, B plus or minus P, with invariants plus 1 and minus 1. So the plus 1 is the matrix algebra, and the minus 1 is the division algebra. Okay, and associated to those guys, of course, I have V plus or minus P, which is just the space of trace zero elements, so the three-dimensional quadratic space with the term, a reduced norm or determinant as quadratic form. So I have these ternary quadratic spaces. And now what's true is that the group G double prime P, which is just the metaplectic cover of SP2 QP, acts on the spaces, the Schwarz space of VP plus or minus two copies. So this is two components. This is the Schwarz space of two copies of this vector space, VP plus or minus P, by the Weyl representation. Omega. Could put a P plus or minus here if you want, but it's too many. It gets boring to write. Okay? So there's a Weyl representation of this group on there. And what happens then is I actually get a map, which I'll call lambda P plus minus, from this Schwarz space, S, V, P plus or minus 2, to I, P of 0. Here I'm taking S equals 0 in this degenerate principal series representation. So there's a map from here to here, an equivariant map. This, of course, is a representation of GP, of this metaplectic cover. This is a representation by the Weyl representation. And the map is defined by taking a Schwarz function here and sending it to, well, you first move it around by your group action. So I'm moving phi around by the action of the group, and then I evaluate at the origin. So if you like, you hit it with the delta function F0. So there's an action, so the point is that this metaplectic group acts in this on such three-dimensional spaces. In fact, if I had any quadratic form over the p-adics, I would get an action of SPN double cover QP on the Schwarz space of N copies of V. So that's why there's a 2. So if I wanted to represent SP1, I just have one copy. If I SP2, it's two copies and so on. So it's just a tensor product, if you like. I mean, the space is a tensor product of the space on which GLN is acting with the space on which the orthogonal group is acting. And the N is the same N, and the GL, this GLN, GL2 acts in a way, I mean, I don't want to write all the formulas down, but this is how it's going. So this is a space on which this Weyl representation, that group acts by the Weyl representation. In any case, if I did write down the formulas, you would see that having taken this function, I act by omega of G, and then evaluate the origin, you would see that that lies in this induced representation. So that's easy to show. It's not some deep fact. It's just the fact that that comes out of the formulas for the Weyl representation. Okay? When you evaluate at zero, you find that the resulting function you get like this is in this induced representation. It's easy to check. Okay? So that's why you get this map. But notice that it's at zero here. And so if we let pi of VP plus minus be the image of this intertwining map, so this is a subspace of IP0, then the basic fact is that First of all, I pi of VP plus or minus is irreducible. This is a fact about the degenerate principal series evaluated at the center of symmetry. These pieces are irreducible inside of here, and the second fact is that, in fact, IP0 is just their direct sum. It's VP plus direct sum pi of VP minus. So this is the local structure of these induced representations. And the point is that this kind of phenomena, where this induced representation here breaks up into precisely a direct sum of these two pieces, can actually be used to prove this local theta dichotomy that I was using last time. Okay? So it's this fact that's behind that local theta dichotomy. And it's also the fact that I'm going to use to choose my section here. So I just wanted to make that link without writing anything more. Okay. So now our problem is to come back to this blackboard and to define this finite part of a section, which I'd like to put here to get the Eisenstein series we really want. And so it turns out that in this business, we're going to be as close to the unramified vector as we can possibly get. Okay? So to get the unramified vector in this representation, which has to occur for almost all p, what I would do is this. I would take OP to be the maximal order in, let's say, BP plus, and then I can let VP be the characteristic function of, I intersect this OP with VP plus. And then, of course, I need two copies because it's going to be an element. This will be a function in the Schwarz space of VP plus squared. So this is the Schwarz function I take. So just the characteristic function of two copies of the... Okay, it's this. And then finally, we can define phi p 0, and I'm putting 0 because this will be the spherical vector in this representation, of 0, to be equal to lambda p plus of phi p, let's call this phi p plus. So it's just the image of that in this Wey representation. The image of that element of the Schwarz space under this map. And so that gives you a section here, which is the spherical vector. This is the unramified vector, hence the 0. Okay. But now, in our global situation, there's some ramification. There's some primes dividing dB, and so we need something more general than this. Okay, and so there's two choices of here that are very close to this. So what we can do here, for example, is we can take RP, or let's say OPE, to be the Eichler order of level P inside of there. So this is an order where you'd have a P in the corner as opposed to just all M2ZP, which is what we're talking about here because this is just the matrix algebra. So you can take this Eichler order, and you proceed in exactly the same way. I'll let you imagine. I won't try to rewrite it. Take two copies of the Eichler order here. And then you can define another section, which I'll call phi PE of 0, which is just lambda P plus of phi PE. So this is another guy, and this will be invariant under the Iwahori, some para-Hori subgroup for this parabolic. Okay? And also, I should say one more thing. We want an S here, and so what we do is we put phi P0 of S to be the standard extension of this. That is to say, these functions are constant on K. On the compact open, they don't depend on S. Okay? So there's a standard way of extending this as a function of S from the point 0. Okay? So that's what this means. This is at 0, and this is at S. And so similarly here, I have a function like that. And then finally, there's one more function which is important, and that is I take a maximal order in BP minus in the division algebra. I do the analogous construction with the map lambda P minus, the three-dimensional space here, the same kind of construction, and I'll get a function phi P minus of S. There'll be a section like this, okay, by analogy. So this is for the division algebra. So I've now got these three sections at a prime P. This one is still the unramified section, but these two are para-Hori invariant. So this is like gamma 0 P, except for SP2. Okay. And so finally, in constructing my Eisenstein series with the B, I'm going to use a combination of this one and one more. And the other one is called phi tilde P. And so it has the following definition. It's a little complicated, but I'll explain where it comes from in a moment. So this is phi p minus of s plus a certain constant function, or certain function of s, times phi p 0 of s plus a function bp of s times phi p e of s. So it's some combination of the spherical guy with these two parahori invariant guys. Okay? The coefficients are functions of s. Now, the coefficients are not completely determined, and as I don't care, you see, in the end, I'm only going to be interested in the value and derivative at zero, at s equals zero. So I only need to really specify the germs of these functions up to that order. And that's what I'll do. So I'm going to assume that AP of zero equals BP of zero is equal to zero. So these two things are supposed to vanish at the origin, but their derivatives will also be specified. So AP prime of s of zero is required to be equal to something I don't know by heart. Minus 2 over p squared plus minus 1 log p, and the other one, bp prime at 0, is supposed to be 1 half p plus 1 over p minus 1 log p. So that tells the first two terms, and so that specifies this guy here as far as the first two terms in its Lorentz expansion at 0 is concerned. And of course, you can imagine taking the simplest possible rational function of p to the minus s as your choice of these things, then that's perfectly okay. In other words, there's some very simple function of p to the minus s that you can put as a of s, ap of s, and bp of s. So now I have these two sections, this one and this one with a zero. So finally, putting all this machinery together, I can define the Eisenstein series I want. See where I'm going to put it. Okay. Perhaps I'll put it here so I can save some space. So the Eisenstein series we finally want, this E, the magic one that will match here, E2 tau SB, is the following thing. It's going to be the Eisenstein series. Well, so there's going to be a normalizing factor, which I won't tell you, but it's just some very elementary function of S, depending on P, which whose value at zero is not zero. Zeta of 2S plus 2 times E tau S 3 halves phi tilde b. So it's just an Eisenstein series like this, except I'm normalizing slightly, taking weight 3 halves. And finally, I didn't tell you what phi tilde b is, so let me do that here somewhere. I'm trying to squeeze a little bit too much, but it doesn't matter. Finally, phi tilde b of s is equal to the product. So this will be a section. Oops, it has to have a b upstairs. This is supposed to be a section of this induced representation, the finite Adels, the global section. And what I do is, for primes dividing dB, now you see I'm now back over on this blackboard in terms of notation, that I have fixed a quaternion algebra, indefinite quaternion algebra B from the outset. Okay, so now I'm referring to that B. Okay, so I take P divides dB, and at those primes I take this funny section that I defined down there with the three components. And at all the remaining primes, I take phi 0 of p, the unramified section. And now, except that I haven't told you what eta of sb is, you know this Eisenstein series precisely. So let me finally just say a word or two about the motivation for this bizarre choice here. This section is not standard. This will definitely vary as a function of s on k. It's not a standard section. It has the property that at 0, as a section, these parts are gone, and this part only remains. So I'm in the minus part. The reason this is taken is it comes out of the geometry. Now, this choice of section comes out of the geometry, and it will have to do, as maybe we'll see late in the lecture, with the bad reduction of the Shimura curve at this point, at this prime dividing dB. Okay? And so what happens is that this section was chosen. It's determined by properties involving the bad reduction. Okay. The whole section. And that particular combination that you have to take is determined because you would like some, what I call the density identity for some intersection number from inner geometry with some derivative, some Whitaker function attached to this, and that's what fits the geometry. Okay. Okay. So in any case, we now have this Eisenstein series completely defined, and you see, if we go back to our program, what we're trying to do here, we're trying to compare these two sides here. And so the point is that we're going to be interested in, I'm going to come back and discuss the geometry a little bit later, but while we're talking about the Eisenstein series, the natural thing to do next is to think a little bit about the Fourier coefficients of this Eisenstein series, because that's what we're going to need to know here. These Fourier coefficients of the derivative at zero is what we need. Now, I should mention one more thing, and I don't want to try to get into all of the dichotomy and incoherent kind of business, but this particular Eisenstein series has the property that its value at zero is zero. So we said it has a meromorphic analytic continuation, and we said that zero is the point we were interested in, and if you evaluate the series there, you get the beautiful value zero, okay? Which, of course, is why we're interested in the derivative, but okay. I just thought I should mention that. Of course, what that means is that the Fourier coefficients of this guy for any given Fourier coefficient has the same property. It vanishes at zero, so I need to look at its derivative. Okay. So the next thing to do then is to study... Yes, yes. Well, a combination of two things. If I had taken the section over there to just have the minus without those A, S, and B, S terms, then it would be exactly because of the functional equation, because then it's incoherent. It has an odd functional equation. I have these extra terms, which means I will have some incoherent Eisenstein series floating in there, but they will always have these coefficients, which you can factor out in the formation of the Eisenstein series, which also vanish. Okay, so those are both mixed together. And by the way, when you do the doubling, again, this is anticipating what happens later, the reason that in this doubling identity I got both a formula for the value and for the derivative is that in there I have things where the vanishing is caused by the coefficient, not by the section. Okay. Okay, so what I'd like to do next is to discuss the Fourier coefficients of this Eisenstein series that I've defined over there. So let's only, however, discuss the non-singular Fourier coefficients of this Eisenstein series. So these are easier. And so I'm going to be interested in E, T, and just for writing's sake, I'm going to start dropping this 2 down here, which is just telling you the genus, not the weight. So the 3 halves and 2 are both the rates. Otherwise, I'll have to write constantly. It's too much to write. Okay. So I'm interested in these Fourier coefficients, the Fourier coefficients of this Eisenstein series. And as I said, the non-singular ones, meaning the determinant of T is not equal to zero, and let's assume once and for all that this is in sim 2 of z, although I'll explain as I go along the fact that it has to be integral by the way I've set things up here. Okay, maybe it's semi-integral, but I'm not being so careful with 2. Anyway, I have a non-singular Fourier coefficient, and so the main fact about the non-singular Fourier coefficients of such an Eisenstein series is that they have a product formula. This is very similar to the familiar fact about elliptic modular Eisenstein series that the Fourier coefficients are divisor functions, which are multiplicative. So this is the analog. And so this thing has a formula as follows. So this is this non-singular Fourier coefficient. It looks like some Whitaker function at infinity of tau and s. Notice, by the way, also that I've restricted in this setup so that the only variable here is the Archimedean variable. I mean, just in this business that I did here with this construction, I've thrown away the dependence on the finite part, which comes back by strong approximation. So I haven't lost anything, in fact, in terms of information. So that's the Archimedean thing times a product over all finite primes of some coefficient depending on T and P, but not on tau anymore. So it has this form. And this would be basically your divisor function part, and if you really wanted to write this out, this is some confluent hypergeometric function of matrix argument defined by Shimura, blah, blah, blah. Okay, it's a big messy thing. Okay. And I've normalized it, right. So secretly in here, I have to stick in the normalizing factor, right? Right, so that's what the zeta of 2s is. And you'll see in a moment when I write down what these are that many of them are 1, not some simple reciprocal of a simple Euler factor, right? So that's... the normalization does that. Okay, but now the key fact that will be behind trying to understand the structure, more structure in these Fourier coefficients is the following lemma. Okay, so lemma is this. If I have T in sim 2, and let's just work over the field Q now, not even, this is not a fact about integral things, this is a fact about rational quadratic forms, with det T not equal to zero, so I have a 2 by 2 form like this, then there exists a unique quaternion algebra BT over Q such that T is represented by V upper T. Now, in all these lectures, I've gotten to the point where if I write down a quaternion algebra and then I say V, so B upper T and V upper T simply mean that this is the quadratic space of trace zero elements in this quaternion algebra. So there's always a way of passing from a quaternion algebra, take the elements of trace zero, and take the quadratic form defined by the determinant on there, or the reduced norm on there. So there's always, for each quaternion algebra, there's a ternary quadratic space. And what I'm saying is that as you vary over all the possible quaternion algebras, if you specified such a binary quadratic form, there is a unique quaternion algebra such that T is represented by this guy. Rationally. Yes, yes. Okay, so globally. And the proof is simply the following identity. The matrix for the quadratic form, let's call it Q upper T, the quadratic form on this space, is simply T, because it has to be for some basis, it has to represent T, but it's T is two-dimensional, this is three-dimensional, so there's only one thing left, but the determinant is also specified. All these determinants are the same as the determinant of the original V, globally. Okay? When you twist the quaternion algebra, it doesn't change this determinant. And so this is the formula. That's the quadratic. It's the quaternion algebra whose quadratic form over Q is given by this matrix. That's the whole thing. So this is an important point, that each T determines a quaternion algebra, and such that it, the VT, the corresponding three-dimensional space, represents T. Okay. So this has a lot of consequences. So let me try to write them up above here. Well, because you see, again, as I said, if I start with my original B on the first blackboard, there was a V, it has a determinant, that's fixed. Right. And they're all the same for all quaternion algebras. Up to squares, globally. Okay. So, of course, this is just an isomorphism class of quadratic form. Okay. So, given this fact, actually, I should have written it up here. Maybe I'll switch these boards. Given this lemma, we can make the following definition, and that is we can let diff of T B. You see, B has been given to us in the outset, where there was a B fixed at the very first. And now for any form T, non-singular quadratic form, I can define diff of TB to be the set of all primes P such that the invariant at P of this quaternion algebra determined by T is minus the invariant sub P of B. Okay, so it's the places at which this quaternion algebra differs from this BT, which is determined by T. These quaternion algebras have to differ at some places. It might be an empty set. In other words, it might be that B upper T is actually B, but there are some set of places like this where the invariants are the opposite. And it's very easy to check that the cardinality of this set is even. So, for example, if B upper T is equal to B, the set is empty. But otherwise, you start to get things in the set. Okay? So this is an even set of places. Okay. And now, what we find out is that this properties of this Fourier expansion are going to be determined by the diff between B and T. The vanishing properties of this Fourier coefficient will be determined, the basic structure will be determined by this diff set. Okay? Okay, so here are the local vanishing properties that we'll need. Okay, so local vanishing. Okay, so let's look first at the Archimedean one. Of course, this is global. This includes P equals infinity in this business. So we have the following. We have WT infinity of tau 0. So remember, we're interested at the point S equals 0. Maybe I've erased that now. Yeah, I succeeded in erasing it. If we evaluate the Archimedean factor in this Fourier coefficient, this one, at 0, what we get is either Q to the T. This is if T is positive definite, or 0 if signature of T is equal to 1, 1, or 0, 2. Those are the two possibilities. Okay? And I should note that this first case occurs if infinity is in diff TB, because this says that T is a positive definite form, but the space V has signature 1, 2, and it can't represent positive definite binary forms. Okay? So I should put here so. Okay, in this case, if T is positive definite, infinity is in the diff set. And in this case, what we have here is that infinity is not in the diff set. Okay, so that's the Archimedean vanishing. And now the second fact is a non-vanishing fact, and that is that if P does not divide, so now I'm talking about finite primes, 2 dB times determinant of T, so it's sort of a good prime, so it doesn't divide dB, or it's odd, and it doesn't divide the determinant of this particular matrix, this implies that W T P of 0 is equal to 1. And this is because I've normalized. Normally, if you had not normalized the Eisenstein series, you see the inverse of some Euler factor, but I've taken that out. And you can see what it would have been. It would be zeta p of 2s plus 2. Okay, and now the next fact is that for any p, finite prime, we have WTP of 0 is not equal to 0 if and only if, so you actually have a characterization of whether or not something vanishes, if and only if, first of all, T has to be in sim 2 of ZP. Now, we're in the end assuming that our matrices are integral anyway. I was saying that, but this is why. Because if it's not integral at P, then this is 0 because of this statement. Okay? And the second point is that we must have that P is not in diff of TB. In other words, i.e., VPB represents T locally. It's the equivalent statement. Okay? This is if and only if. Okay. So if you look at these various facts, what you discover is some kind of information about when these Fourier coefficients vanish or do not vanish. That's the point. Okay. So let me try to write that down here somewhere. Maybe it's loved here. Well, what I should say, I mean, the infinity versus finite is what you're looking at. And the reason is that, in fact, in my old paper, I defined it differently, so infinity, it would be the opposite. It would be consistent, okay? And I just found it easier to express this because you can use this quaternion algebra B upper T. Right? So that's why there's a slight asymmetry here. Okay. Right. Okay. So here are the conclusions, okay? We conclude. So here are so remember, we have this product formula at the top of this board for these Fourier coefficients, and we have all this vanishing information. So what's true is that most of these coefficients vanish for various reasons. Well, of course, they all vanish. We know that because the Eisenstein series vanishes at zero, so do all the Fourier coefficients. So this thing is zero at S equals zero, that's for sure. Okay, but now what's true is this. So here are the ones which contribute. If we have B upper T is equal to B, then, so this is in the case where the signature of T is either 1, 1 or 0, 2. Then what we get is that E prime T tau 0 B is equal to, well, in this case, the diff set is empty because these quaternion algebras are the same. There's nothing in the diff set. And as you see, what that means, as Jim was just pointing out, that the only thing that can, that the infinity thing here has to be 0. Right? Because of this funny thing. So so for a signature 1, 1, and 0, 2 guys, this the Archimedean coefficient vanishes. Now, what happens is if more than one coefficient vanishes, it's identically 0 in the derivative as well. Okay? And so we're only interested in, if I have something of this signature, it has to be true that BT must be B. Otherwise, there's some finite prime where it vanishes. Some additional difference between these occurs. Some other factor vanishes, and it won't contribute to the derivative. So what happens here then is we just take the derivative of this Archimedean factor times the product over all of these finite factors, which I'm now calling L because P will be in this diff set. So I get this product of these finite factors. That's what the Fourier coefficient looks like. The second case is where B upper T differs from B at some finite prime and infinity. Okay? And we had seen these quaternion algebras before when we talked about p-adic uniformization. These are positive definite, these are definite quaternion algebras ramified at P. And the diff set now is exactly, in this case, the diff set is exactly equal to the set infinity, comma, P. This is a definite quaternion algebra ramified at P, or with the opposite invariant at P. Sorry, not ramified at P. It's the opposite invariant. Okay. So we have this case. And in this case, what happens is that the factor which vanishes is the factor at P. And the Archimedean factor, we're now in this good situation. This is now T is positive definite, because this is here. So T is therefore automatically positive definite for these guys, because this is there. And the factor we differentiate is the pth factor. So in this case, we get the formula that says E prime T of tau 0b is simply equal to Q to the T. We take the value of the Archimedean factor times W prime TP at 0 times the product over L not equal to P of WTL of 0. So we get this structure. And otherwise, it's 0. Okay? So if the cardinality of diff set is greater than 2, this implies that we get 0. Or equal to 2 and containing 2 Archimedean, 2 finite primes, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, so all the other coefficients are 0. These are the only non-singular coefficients we have to deal with. Now, of course, there are singular coefficients, and they don't localize like this. So notice that these coefficients have localized in the sense that there's either infinity, which is the sort of relevant prime here, or P, which is the relevant prime here. And so these coefficients have localized in a certain sense at some fixed prime, whereas the singular coefficients and the constant term don't localize. They're truly global. Okay, you can't compute them prime by prime like this. And I'm not going to discuss them anymore. Okay. So now, let's go back and see what we wanted to prove here. What we're trying to prove is the identity between this thing here and this thing here. Well, actually, I have to include this. Okay. For a fixed T1, T2. So this identity we're trying to prove comes down to an infinite family of identities as I vary the T1 and the T2 here. This side I have this intersection number, and on this side I have the sum of these coefficients with this diagonal where the T has this diagonal. And I'm trying to match those two things. Okay. And so let me actually now state the theorem, which we're going to, then whose proof I will then explain. Okay. So suppose that T1 times T2, now I'm talking about this coefficient here, is not a square. Okay? And assume the P equals 2 density identity, which I'll explain in a little bit. I'm going to come back and say what I mean by the P equals 2 density identity when I explain the proof of this. So if I assume these two things, so this is a suppose and this is an assumption. All right? Then let's call the identity between these two things here identity A, then A holds. Okay? So if T1, T2 is not a square, and assuming this two-adic density thing, which is something which is a question of a few, I would say a month, something like that. I mean, the calculations are in progress, and I have no doubt that they're going to be fine, but it's not finished. Okay? So I'm being careful here. Then if you have that, then this piece here coincides exactly with this sum. And that's what I mean then by the congruence, because as I explained very roughly last time, what's true is that the remaining difference between the two coefficients are square, differ by a square, and this means it's basically coming from distinguished forms, forms which are coming from O1s. This is part of the theory of metaplectic forms, theorem of Gelbart and Piotrowski-Shapiro and so on. Okay? So that once I've proved this statement, I get that thing. Statement A is that this thing in this box is equal to this thing in this box. Equal, right, in these two boxes. And notice the thing in the box depends on T1, T2. Okay, so this is what I was claiming up above. That's what the congruence means, as I just explained. Because if the square, if T1 T times, times T2 is a square, and there is some difference between the two sides up there, it turns out to be just O1 thetas, as you can show. Okay? So this is really what I've claimed. Now, I would have to worry about that, right? I'm going to say that now. Okay. Okay. So let me now give some idea about how this gets proved. Okay. So an idea of the proof, which will include some words about what I mean by the two p equals two density identity. Okay. So here's the idea of the proof. What we need to do. So let's first of all look and see what this t1 t2 not equal to a square assumption implies. Well, the first thing it implies is that only det t not equal to 0 occurs on the right-hand side. Okay? Of A. Because if you, t is probably, yeah, there's a t up there. You can take the determinant of that and check. It can't be 0 if t1, t2 isn't a square. Okay. So T1, T2 is not a square implies that only non-singular terms occur on the right-hand side there, and as we've just seen, the non-singular terms we have quite a strong grip on in terms of computation. Okay. And now the second point, and now we're going to move gradually toward the geometry here. In other words, I'm comparing the two sides. I've already discussed for you the structure of this side, and now I need to discuss the structure of the left-hand side, the structure of these intersections. So the second thing that T1, T2 not equal to 0 implies is that if I take these cycles, z, t1, and you remember this z hat, t1, v1, is just this natural cycle where I have this extra cm together with some Green's function, which is where the v comes from and the hat comes from. Okay? So there's some geometric cycle. This is this curve on m. If I look at its generic fiber and I intersect that with the generic fiber of this guy, that this is empty. And the reason for that is that, after all, this generic fiber is cm points for the imaginary quadratic field q root minus t1. And this is cm points for the imaginary quadratic field q root minus c2, or minus t2. And it turns out that in characteristic zero, these surfaces aren't big enough to support multiplication by by two different imaginary quadratic fields. So in characteristic zero, i.e. on the generic fiber, these cycles cannot intersect if these are different quadratic fields, which is what this is saying. Okay. So this also, you see simultaneously, this assumption means good things on both sides. Okay, so now we're passing toward the geometry, and what does this good thing on the left-hand side and the geometric side mean? What it means is, so I'll just put another implies here for this next statement. What this means is that the height pairing of these two cycles here can be written as a sum on primes. So there's an Archimedean contribution plus a sum on finite primes, and here I will just write it in this form as a z t1 z t2 sub p, because this is just purely intersection theory on the geometry. It doesn't depend on this Chow group, et cetera, et cetera. Just purely intersection theory of these cycles. Okay, so it's just pure geometry, not RKLF theory really. Okay, so this gives us this formula, and so now what we would like to do is we would also like to notice that here I've had an implication, T1, T2 not equal to square means generic fibers disjoint, means I can write this as a sum over primes. On the top line, I could have done the same thing. Namely, once I have det t not equal to zero only occurring on the right-hand side, I can also rewrite, so there should be another implies here, analogous to the one down here. This implies I can write this as a sum on primes as well, as a sum on p. Well, there's an Archimedean part, so I have a sum on T of signature 1, 1 plus signature 2, 0, 2 can't occur because T1 and T2 are positive. Okay? So I get part of this thing. So for a fixed T1, T2, part of it will have signature 1, 1 of these guys, and then I have a sum on T with diagonal of T equal to T1, T2, and then T greater than 0. So I split this up into signature 1, 1 and positive definite ones. And the positive definite ones, each one has a prime attached to it. And so I can say here that diff has a P in it. Okay? And now what you do is you compare the P part for each prime of these two expressions. Okay? So there's a more precise version of this theorem which says, I'm sorry for cramming this in, but I'm once again running short of time. Okay? And I do want to say something about how at least one of these is proved. So the more precise version of this theorem that I stated here about identity A holds is that you get an identity prime by prime of the two sides. So for all P, we have A, P holds. Okay? You could, but it would be gone because you see what happens is that if I have a positive definite form, right? If you have a positive definite form, then the Archimedean one is not zero, right? But if you have now, and infinity is in the diff, if you have one more P, it's okay, it's on my list. If you have two, say, three more P's, which it has an even cardinality, then you have three vanishing local factors, and you'll get zero. So such terms are gone, actually. You can't, in the diff thing, they occur, but in the derivative, you get too many zeros. Okay. Right. That are left here. Yes. Exactly. So these diffs here are empty. So diff here is zero, has cardinality zero, and these have cardinality two, and that's all that can contribute because if it's more, the Fourier coefficient vanishes. Okay. But of course, I haven't said that the height vanishes, and I'm about to explain that. In other words, the vanishing I discussed there was the vanishing of the Fourier coefficient of the Eisenstein series. We still have to see why it's true for this geometric side. Right? That's the question here. Okay, so let's see. Okay, so let me just briefly discuss then here at the end how this last part goes. Well, we're now in a situation where, well, first of all, let me just get rid of this term right away. This comes from the Green functions. This is the Archimedean part of the height pairing, and I'll say nothing more about it because I didn't get time to discuss these Green functions, and it's a big Archimedean calculation, so you do it. They're equal. Okay. So we're only going to consider these terms here and the corresponding terms in the Eisenstein series here. Then those are the positive definite Fourier coefficients. It's enough already, you'll see. Okay, so we're now in a situation where we're trying to intersect two cycles, ZT1 and ZT2. As I said, this is just a question of intersection theory. These cycles have no common horizontal components. That's what this generic fiber disjoint tells you. There's no common horizontal components. There can be vertical components in common, however. But anyway, if I take the fiber product of these two guys over M, so really I should have said somewhere that these ZTs map to M because there's a triple A iota X, and you just forget the X. So there's really, these things really are schemes over M. And if I take the fiber product of two of these guys over M, I claim, so this is a lemma, that this is a disjoint union over T in sim 2 of Z with diagonal of T is equal to T1, T2, and the T has got to be greater than or equal to 0. This is for all T, for any T1, T2, of a certain cycle, ZT, which I think I may have even defined in the first lecture as the locus where I had an abelian variety. So what is this thing? This is the locus where I have an A, iota, and an X, where X is a pair, X1, X2, whose matrix of inner products is the given T. That's what this cycle is. And, of course, this is obvious, because if I have a point of intersection of these two things here, at that point, I have not only an A iota and X1 from here, but also an A iota and X2. In other words, I have a pair, X1, X2, and the pair has a matrix of inner products, and it has to be, after all, the quadratic form on the space of special endomorphisms is positive semi-definite and integer-valued, so that matrix must be positive semi-definite and integer-valued, and the diagonal is this, because, of course, the length on the diagonal is just the length of the given guys, which are fixed already here. So this is obvious. Okay, so what happens then is this intersection locus can be decomposed according to positive semi-definite quadratic forms. And under our assumption that T1, T2 is not equal to a square, we know that det T is not equal to zero. In other words, in this sum, only positive definite guys occur. This lemma is true for in general, but in the case where that we're concerned with here, only positive definite T's can occur. Okay, and so now what you can imagine is that on the surface, M, I now have these two horizontal curves going through here like this, or these two curves, so this is, say, ZT1, and this is ZT2, and they're going to have some points of intersection in some characteristic P, and so this typically, and I didn't draw it fancy enough, maybe one should have it crossed several times here in this fiber, this is the cycle ZT. At this point, there are two endomorphisms, and there's a matrix T. And so if I want to compute the intersection number of these things, I can break it down according to the contribution of each of these. Okay? Now, the second thing to notice is that, in fact, this T is represented by V of A iota, because there's a pair of endomorphisms which have this matrix T. And so this thing must be isomorphic if we tensor with Q, so I'll put 0 in the traditional fashion, to VT. And so since VT is uniquely determined, this shows that each of these cycles lives in exactly one characteristic P. There's only one prime P that's determined by T. Okay, so this is, and in fact, this thing is in diff of TB. That's the prime. That prime in here, infinity is the other thing in here, that prime determines where the cycle occurs. It's in that fiber, this cycle ZT. Okay, that's the first thing. And there are various other things that about it. Maybe I'll just, well, I'm close to the end here, so, okay. Bear with me another minute or two. I haven't run over yet, and I mean, today I've run over, but I haven't run over previously. Okay. So let me just say, list a few facts here. The first one, let me again call this another lemma. The first fact is that ZT Q is equal to empty. So notice this ZT, these components are in characteristic P, for finite characteristic. I already rather explained that. The second thing is that it's concentrated if the diff of T and B has cardinality bigger than 0, this implies that ZT, or bigger than 2, it implies that ZT is empty. So now the only T's that occur here have cardinality diff containing equal to 2, so it contains exactly infinity in P, and so I'll write that diff of TB equals infinity comma P implies that ZT has support inside of the fiber at P for the same P. So that's the picture. Okay. So finally we're ready to calculate the I'd rather not write it because yes. Yes. Right. Then it's empty because of the previous line. Well, I mean, T is always positive definite here. T is positive definite here, so infinity is always in this. Yeah, okay. So anyway, this says where to look at the intersection. So now finally, we want to compute this intersection number associated to these things. But there's one more thing that can happen. Here I've drawn the nice picture. This is the case where P does not divide DB, where in fact this ZT is a finite set of points in the fiber MP. So if this diff prime is not dividing DB, then you just get a finite number of points. They're super singular points, and they're discrete set in this case. The other case is, so this is P does not divide DB. The other case is P divides DB. And in that case, what can happen is these original pair of cycles could have themselves lots of vertical components. And when you intersect the two of them, you could still have lots of vertical components. These vertical components can completely cover the special fiber. That can happen. Okay? So what happens in the second case, P divides DB, is that ZT is a vertical curve. It's a big combination of components of this fiber with multiplicities. And we have to attach a number to this thing. Okay. So let me tell you in detail or a little bit more about the story in the first case, and I'm going to leave the second case for another occasion maybe. Okay, so let's finish this off. Okay, so let's suppose we're in the good case, if you like. The case P does not divide DB. So we have this zero cycle in this fiber. It's just a finite number of points, and each of them occurs with some multiplicity. And so the fact is then all points of ZT have the same multiplicity. Okay? That's a fact. And we'll call that multiplicity delta sub P of T. And so what we see is that the contribution, and let me just call it Z hat of T, this will be the contribution of this piece to this intersection number that we're trying to calculate over here. Okay? So this little piece of intersection here will contribute something to the number we're trying to calculate. Okay? So we'll call that something Z hat of T. What this is, if Z of T is equal to spec of RT, so it's just an Artin ring, then by definition, this is just the log of the cardinality of this R of T. But what is it? Well, it's going to be equal to the number of points in the support, each of which has the same multiplicity. And then there's a log P. So this is the formula. Okay? And now what happens is that if you look at the board above, we're in the second case here, where the diff set is infinity comma P and T is a positive definite matrix. And what happens is this. This number, this multiplicity, can be expressed in terms of some deformation problem with p-divisible groups. These are supersingular elliptic curves at the point in question, and there's some deformation problem with p-divisible groups which determines the length of a little Artin ring, which is the multiplicity at that point. And that length was computed by Gross and Keating in a rather more general situation. So this is a special case of Gross and Keating. It gives you a formula for delta P of T, which I put in the notes and I won't take time to write up here. It's a completely explicit formula for delta P of T. Okay. On the other hand, if you look at the corresponding coefficient here, it will turn out, and so this is the theorem that's true if P is not equal to 2, we know that delta P of T, by explicit computation of the derivative of this degenerate Whitaker function, is equal to W prime P TP at 0. There's also, I guess, the log P has to go over here. Okay? So this times log P is just equal to this derivative of this Whitaker function. Okay? And So this is one of the deeper mysteries in the subject, namely, this comes out of the deformation theory of p-divisible groups. This comes out of representation densities of quadratic forms and information about representation densities, some completely different thing, and derivatives of representation densities. And these are equal. Okay? And this, for p is not equal to 2, this side we know, in other words, the Gross-Keating p equals 2 is okay. In this case, we haven't checked the right-hand side. And that's what I mean by the P equals 2 density formula. Okay? So once we've developed the formula for this thing and can compare it with this, I will expect we'll have a match here, and then you can erase that line up there. Okay? But this is what needs to be done. The left-hand side is computed. The right-hand side is not. Okay, well, I haven't quite said something about the match. The last thing is, what about the number of points? Okay, so the number of points is simply equal to this. And this is by the Ziegle formula for the space VP. And so you... this thing? Well, the problem, of course, is this is one of these cases where, of course, T is not a unit. And so it's a very ramified situation. It's very, very messy. The formulas for these Whitaker functions are very, very messy. And you need a completely explicit formula. And then you have to take its derivative at 0. And for P equals 2, it's extremely messy. So that's the problem. Okay, so anyway, you have this is the density. So the upshot is that this is the density coming from the p-divisible groups multiplicity, and this counts the number of points. And that gives you that for a given T, the piece on this side, which is the Fourier coefficient, coincides with the contribution of the corresponding T on the left-hand side. The left-hand side, as we said, is the sum. This is already taken care of. This is for these p's. But now, of course, there's P divides DB, so let me finish with that. I'll just say that it's analogous, but much harder. And so when P divides DB, this is a picture of ZT, but what happens is basically this thing, this isn't maybe a good picture. The picture I'd like to draw would be something like this. There's some certain number of copies of some configuration. So there's a p-adic uniformization here. And so this intersection curve, messy though it may be, is just the quotient. It's the image of something in the p-adic upper half plane, which is infinite but is now acted on by a gamma, and you mod out. All right? And so what's true here is that the computation of the contribution of this guy to the intersection number breaks into two problems. One is counting how many blobs there are here, how many of these chunks, irreducible pieces there are, and then each piece, there's an analog of this, all points contribute the same amount, each of these contributes the same amount, and this is a calculation that you can do in the Drinfeld space, and you can calculate that multiplicity. So once again, there's a delta P of T, which is this multiplicity of an individual piece and a counting function. And what's true is that this delta P of T is exactly this derivative, and the counting function is this piece. But you remember that I had made that really strange non-standard section on the right-hand side, and that's why. Because with that choice of section, this thing is indeed equal to the delta P of T for these blobs, for all T. So as I chose a section, it doesn't know what T is. But once you choose that section, as you vary the T, any T of this form, it's right. And so it's not as much of a fudge as you might think. It's actually quite rigid. And so that's the end of the story. Sorry for going over.
So in the case just described, so what would be then the interpretation for the derivative in the good part if it were the representation density?
Well, what's true here is, of course, these will also, the right-hand side in both cases is representation densities. But what happens is that the densities, what you see the derivative of the density for one representation of a quadratic form with some lattice, and then you see values with these derivatives of the A and the B. And that's a formula that's equal to this delta P of T. It's a linear combination of derivative of density plus some values. And the A's and B's were put in there to fix that so that it works. But it works for all T. This is important. So that it's not that for one T, okay, you can do anything you want. Put that T in there, but it's true that you take those combinations, then for all T it's true. So it's quite a strong thing. Plus, the last nice thing about that particular section is that when I did the doubling integrals, Tong Hai and I worked out these doubling integrals in Beijing last summer, it just worked magically, these strange sections, when you put them in the doubling integral for the special representation for the metaplectic group, it just works perfectly. So the strange coefficients, for example, all cancel. Something that comes out of the doubling, the A's and the B's and so on. Okay. So, I mean, the point is that, yeah. So, right. So the point is this, that first of all, you can calculate it on the formal completion, the formal neighborhood and so on. So you have you can pass the ZP or the VIT vectors, algebraic closure and so on. And so then there's just a formulation due to Deligne that says if you have cycles which intersect on such a scheme, a two-dimensional surface over a DVR, a curve over a DVR, if you look at intersections, as long as the intersection support of the intersection is in the special fiber, you can make a definition. And essentially what it is simply the following. You take the structure sheaf of the two cycles, ZT1, tensor L, O, ZT2, and in this particular case, we restrict it to this particular component of the intersection and take this. Yeah, so that's it. And so it has tors and so on in it. That's what we're using here, right? So that's the part for given T, and that's this thing, which then is related to the intersection. So you have to, of course, be careful because it's not proper. It's strange. I mean, it's not good intersections. And, of course, in higher dimensions, it's not at all clear how one would hope to do this. For example, if you had a case in which you had the whole thing, the fibers had surfaces living there or something, I mean, you're really in trouble. Okay. Any other questions?